fallen short on your rubber collection, and you know your child would pay that price, or your family member would pay that price. You know, even you yourself would pay that price. So imagine that going on for years, day in, day out, years. It's easy for anyone to see that 10 million is an understatement.
What exactly is happening today in Congo? Because we see growing calls by the Congolese for the United Nations to even leave the country.
Yes, there are cries by the Congolese population to have MONUSCO expelled. I think MONUSCO is the UN mission in Congo, something like that. And it isn't for, and this cause is for a justified reason by the Congolese people, that throughout the decades that the MONUSCO has been active, they have questioned their input, because the Congolese people are being slaughtered. And oftentimes you see that the MONUSCO entity doesn't act, or the UN entity doesn't act, only when it benefits them. I don't know if you're aware, but I think it was last year, a UN truck in the eastern part of the Congo overturned, and out of the vehicle came bags of minerals. So for the Congolese people, they are literally tired of being exploited. They're literally tired of this pseudo-sense of, we're here to protect you, because that is not what is ongoing. The UN is plundering the wealth of the Congolese people, the wealth of the Congolese land.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Hidden Files. So many of the horror stories in Congo's past involve rubber slavery. The oppression of this nation today has far more to do with another type of resource. You see, in addition to its limitless water supply, rich forests, and fertile soil, Congo is home to some of the world's most precious and most used minerals. Congo has abundant mineral deposits of cobalt, gold, diamonds, petroleum, potash, lead, zinc, uranium, copper, phosphates, gold, manganese, natural gas, coltan, and a whole lot more. Congo's untapped raw deposits of raw materials are actually estimated at being $24 trillion. Imagine that, $24 trillion. And Congo is the world's fourth largest producer of copper, copper that we use so much in this modern world of ours. 60% of the coltan on the planet, the reserves are in Congo. And perhaps most importantly, the country produces 70% of the world's cobalt, which is used in phones and laptops and other high-tech tools. You see, it's the Congolese who are the true owners of the cobalt. It's the Congolese who harvest it with their hands and unsafe mines. And it's the Congolese who suffer all kinds of health issues and birth defects as a result of this dangerous hands-on approach to cobalt harvest. And yet in 2018, over 70% of the Congolese lived on less than $1.90 a day. Clearly, even though their country is no longer the private property of a Belgian king, they continue to have little to no share in their rich national resources. But how is this happening today in what's now called the DRC, or the Democratic Republic of Congo? Our next guest has some interesting answers, so let's find out more.
Tede Kofi is a broadcast journalist with credits on the BBC World Service and BBC Radio 5, where he presented Current Affairs magazine programs. Tede is a newspaper publisher and ran the Ethnic Media Group, publishing Asian and Afro-Caribbean titles. He has been a crisis, media coach, and consultant for multinational corporations, specializing in the arena of diversity management.
Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. We appreciate you being with us today on the program. I want your assessment of the effects of Leopold Rain you think could have had on the overall psyche of the Congolese.
The barbarity, the savagery and the cruelty that Leopold II wreaked on the Congo is one of the world's best-kept secrets. It is estimated that 10 million Congolese died, that he reduced the population of the country by about 70%. In the early days of Leopold, each Congolese man, able-bodied man, was supposed to produce 15 kilograms of rubber per day. If he did not produce that, his family would be rounded up, herded, and killed. And so if people didn't produce their quota, their hands were amputated. There were these bizarre scenes of people presenting like strings of male genitalia, Congolese male genitalia, just to show how many people that they had killed that day because they hadn't made their quota. Now, all of this was covered up by Leopold as an exercise in civilizing the savages, which we Africans were presented as. So he said that basically in the Congo Free State, which is basically my private fiefdom, I've gone over there to introduce them to God and Christianity. And of course, the missionaries were under dire admonitions never to reveal the truth, which of course ultimately leaked, because as slavery was abolished elsewhere, people started to ask questions about how Leopold was running this enterprise. And of course, the whole thing blew up in his face, and he then had to resort to burning all the national records to try and cover up and hide a genocide which was, you know, in plain view. So again, this is another way in which, if you have lived through that kind of, let me call it a Holocaust, it's probably the greatest human genocide kind of in living memory. If you've been through that kind of genocide, the idea is to instill in the people obedience to authority and power.
How is it, though, that the exploitation of the Democratic Republic of Congo is still existing today, has taken place for so long a period of time?
The oldest playbook in method in the playbook of any totalitarian or any controller is divide and rule. Divide and rule requires that because there are few of the abusers, you must get the people you are abusing to fight each other. As long as they are fighting each other, they cannot unite, because it is only when they are united that they can kick you out of your position of authority, command, and control. And so it is that Congo has always been destabilized by foreign powers and foreign interests who have a profound desire, but whose lifestyles are determined by the cheapness with which they can extract the strategic minerals that I listed before.
Right.
And so that is how it's played out for the Congo. And another way is to make sure that you have proxy governments which are propped up by foreign powers, doing essentially the bidding of the foreign powers, so that they can be the natural and easy exfiltration of the nation's wealth to the benefit of the foreign powers. So that's how it's always played. Divide and rule, proxy governments which are created by the foreign powers, and thus it has been to this very day. In fact, now there is another challenge, because colonialism moved to another stage when, by using local agents, the destabilization could be maintained. And even now, if you speak to any Congolese, they will tell you that the role of Rwanda is a very difficult one in their country. And many Congolese blame a lot of the conflicts, internal conflicts within the country, on the actions not only of the Rwandese, but also of the Ugandans.
Why haven't we seen reparations for the Congolese after all of the suffering that they have gone through?
For a crime to be expunged, you need recognition that the crime happened, you need regret for the crime happening, and you need recompense. Now, in terms of recognition of the crime happening, my goodness, if you ask anybody what comes out of Congo, what they'll tell you is Makalele, Vincent Kompany, Lua Lua, and Romelu Lukaku. They're top football players. Most people in the world don't even know what the history of the Congo is beyond some trite superficial modernities. In terms of regret, when the tooth of Patrice Lumumba was handed back to his family, here is the thing. There was no official apology, either on behalf of the Belgian state or on behalf of Leopold II, who committed most of those atrocities. So there is no regret there. And as for compensation, well, Congo's wealth is still being filched out of the country on a daily basis. And the parties who benefit from this are absolutely adamant about the maintenance of their profits. So it's a perfect storm for Africa's richest country. And you've got to think about the bigger picture as well. When Nkrumah stood up in Ghana, the independence of Africa was signaled. When Lumumba stood up in the Congo, the independence of the Congo was signaled. And the thing about these things is that they attract people who follow the cause. And so it is important in the interest of the controlling powers that Congo doesn't become as wealthy as she can be. What if then she starts supporting the rest of the other African countries, and then the yoke of colonialism will be broken one by one by one across the continent? If you want to defeat an enemy, you first defeat their champion, and Congo can be the champion of Africa. Just indeed, as Muammar Gaddafi could have been the champion of Africa. Look what happened to him.
Well, what is it going to take, in your perspective, to turn around the fate of the Democratic Republic of Congo?
All I can say is that if people are severely abused over a long period of time, it takes time for these people to heal, for them to find their center, and to make demands based on their own self-validation. So that work has to take place. But that work has to take place right now in the face of overwhelming media coverage, which makes sure that the only things people associate Congo with is Claude Makélélé and Victor Kompany, football players. People don't know outside of Africa the value and the condition of Congo. So all of this applies very, very negative pressure. On the other hand, the international community must write a new set of rules. And that set of rules should mean that all people, as said in the United Nations Charter, deserve respect and recognition. But at the moment, you know, the world is run by what one cartoonist called the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. And so as long as you've got this sort of moral relativism, it's going to be very challenging.
Thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Tete Kufi. Appreciate it. But when we talk about the advancement of technology, we often think of prestigious universities and creative minds. Unfortunately, we rarely remember the suffering of hands without whose harvest the main ingredients of advancement would be missing. Hands like those of the Congolese that were cut off for the sake of rubber and the harvest of cobalt. The pain must be acknowledged and the price be paid. But from the Belgian monarchy that has brought about the genocide of the Congolese to the international corporations and various countries that continue to profit from the toil of the Congolese and the taking away of their resources, no entity has acknowledged the crime committed against these people, let alone apologize. Yet even a formal apology can hardly ever appease the victims of such horrible crimes. What good would an apology have done, for instance, the Congolese man who had to stare in shock at the severed body parts of his 5-year-old daughter? I can't even begin to imagine. Well, a true apology must be followed by a change in actions and in reparations, such as those that has for decades been paid by German citizens to those related to victims of Nazi atrocities. Perhaps someday soon, the oppressed nations of the world will begin to have the power to extract this apology from colonial powers of the past and present. But this power requires knowledge. For now, though, that's goodbye for me and all the crew right here at Hidden Files. Thank you so much for being with us, and let us hear from you, from your corner of the world. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Around 72% of UK citizens believe that leaving the EU has had a negative economic impact. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, a majority of Britons now regret Brexit and want to rejoin the European Union, a YouGov poll published recently has revealed. 7 years on from the referendum campaign in the UK, the pollster said 52% of those surveyed now believe it was wrong to leave the EU, and 7 out of 10 support having closer ties with the bloc. The YouGov poll also shows that 57% of Britons would now support joining the single market, even if that means the resumption of the free movement of people. Curbing immigration was among the key reasons why Britons voted to leave the EU in 2016. The survey was released shortly after the latest data revealed that annual net migration to the UK has hit a record high. According to the country's Office for National Statistics, non-EU immigration was estimated to be around 968,000 for the year ending June 2023, an increase of 120,000 compared with the year ending June 2022. In the year ending June 2023, this group accounted for 82% of total immigration. In general, the poll shows that 72% of Britons believe Brexit has had a negative economic impact. The poll comes as inflation remains at historic highs in Britain and economic growth is stagnant, with economists warning about the continuing impact of Brexit on trade and investment. According to a report in late September, London may surrender its lead as one of the world's finance capitals, a status it shares with New York, according to a majority of executives at corporate major polled by Lloyds Bank. The bank's financial institution sentiment survey showed that 64% of sector leaders think that the City of London will stagnate as a global hub compared to its rivals, business-focused newspaper City AM reported recently. The City of London, widely referred to simply as the City, is a historic financial district and home to both the London Stock Exchange and the Bank of England. Lisa Francis, Managing Director at Lloyds Bank Corporate and Institutional Banking, told the newspaper, "The City of London's status as a leading financial center is an inflection point. The district has reportedly faced something of a crisis in confidence. Several firms have steadily abandoned London's listed markets, opting for other major stock exchanges." UK chip designer Arm successfully debuted on New York's Nasdaq stock exchange after British government failed to persuade the tech firm to list in the UK. A quarter of companies surveyed by the bank say they would prefer to relocate some of their UK-based staff overseas if London loses its status as one of the world's leading finance hubs in the next 5 years. A number of factors, including political uncertainty, Brexit, and increased international competition, mean that we cannot be complacent that it will always be at the very top, said David Gook, head of public policy at McFarlane's and a former Treasury minister as cited by the media. In December, Chancellor Jeremy Hunt announced a package of reforms known as the Edinburgh Reforms in response to the concerns. The measures are meant to unlock investment and turbocharge growth by repealing and repealing burdensome pieces of retained EU law. So far, the UK government has passed the flagship Financial Services and Markets Bill that authorises local regulators to make decisions previously made at an EU-wide level. Some 80% of respondents said better relations between UK and EU would help enhance London's status. Two-fifths said there should be a relaxation of immigration rules for skilled workers. Gook said the UK needs to demonstrate that we are committed to bring an open economy, willing to attract talent and investment here, prepared to embrace innovation, but also capable of providing political and regulatory stability. According to Press TV, a new study has shown that the UK cost of living crisis, which mainly results from the British government's economic policy, is set to cause premature deaths among thousands of people this year. Millions of Britons have been hit hard with levels of inflation not seen since 1970s as a result of the war in Ukraine, COVID-19, Brexit, and economic policy. Poorer households have borne the brunt as they spend a larger proportion of their income on energy, the cost of which has soared during the recent month.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States. Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
This is a firm response to Israel's genocide and aggression against Palestinians. It has been about 2.5 months since Israel launched its deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Muslim countries missed no chance to deplore the Israeli crimes verbally, but there were few, including Yemen, that firmly stood in solidarity with defenseless Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. After carrying out drone and missile strikes on Israeli targets, Yemen's armed forces have now been targeting Israel-bound vessels in waters around their country. The army has time and again stated it would stop its operations if Israel stops its aggression and ends its blockade on Gaza. The Yemeni armed forces have also refuted claims about targeting ships moving toward other destinations. All vessels except Israel-bound ones can safely sail through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. As usual, Israel's main backer, the U.S., has been trying to reverse the impact of the Yemeni operations by announcing the formation of a maritime coalition under the pretext that it would protect the transit in the Red Sea. But Washington's main goal is to protect Israel's interest. However, Yemen's Ansarullah has issued strong warning to the U.S. Mohammed al-Bukhaiti, a senior Ansarullah official, says the newly formed coalition will get a painful response if it violates the sovereignty of the Arab country. But how significant the Yemeni operations in the Red Sea are? In recent weeks, Yemeni naval forces have targeted several vessels sailing through the Red Sea toward Israel. Their primary goal has been to exert economic pressure on Tel Aviv, and they have been rather successful. Several major companies have suspended their shipments to and from Israel in the wake of Yemen's operations in the Red Sea. This has dealt a heavy blow to Israel's economy, with the latest reports indicating that the port of Eilat is hardly hit as the result of this disruption.
The non-arrival of ships to Eilat means that there is no income for the port, while the fixed expenses for its maintenance and operation remain the same, and we have a substantial negative flow.
The almost complete halt to the arrival of ships to Eilat has led to an 80% fall in the port's profits. This is while reports say that Egypt's Suez Canal has seen no harm to its maritime activities during Yemen's operations against Israel-bound ships. The Red Sea is a strategic trade route connecting Asia to Europe through the Suez Canal. About 12% of global trade passes through the Red Sea, including 30% of global container traffic. The disruptions in this area have had a direct impact on global economy. Now, cargo ships traveling from Asia to Europe have to sail around the African continent. This has increased the transit time and led to higher freight rates and delays. Also, shipping insurance costs have jumped by tens of thousands of dollars a day, and oil prices have gone up as well. To sum up, the international community has been unable to stop the Israeli crimes against Palestinians through political means. However, it seems Yemenis have employed a successful tactic to pressurize Israel.
The axis of resistance is fighting Israel and its main supporter, the US, on different fronts, as the regime continues its brutal aggression on the Gaza Strip. In the besieged territory, the Al-Qassam and Al-Quds brigades are fighting Israeli forces and inflicting heavy losses on them. Scores of Israeli tanks and military vehicles have been destroyed in more than 10 weeks of clashes. The regime's casualties among its soldiers are also increasing dramatically. A report came out earlier this month saying that a total of 2,000 Israeli soldiers have received psychological assistance since the genocide began on October 7. But the rising casualties are not the only problem for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Dozens of captives held by resistance groups have been killed in the regime's indiscriminate bombings of Gaza. On Friday, three of the captives were shot dead by Israeli soldiers. As fighting continues in Gaza, resistance groups across the West Asia region have risen against the Israeli regime. In Lebanon, Hezbollah has been attacking Israeli soldiers and bases along the country's southern border since October 8, a day after the Al-Aqsa flood operation. Places like Hunin and Beyaz Belida have been repeatedly hit by drones and missiles. The attacks have forced Israel to evacuate several towns and cities near Lebanon. Iraqi resistance groups have also staged hundreds of attacks against U.S. bases, both in Iraq and neighboring Syria, over Washington's unconditional support for Israel. They believe that the U.S. is behind Israeli crimes. According to the Pentagon, American bases in Iraq and Syria have been attacked over 100 times since October 7. At least 60 U.S. troops in Syria and Iraq have reportedly suffered injuries during the attacks. Yemenis have also expressed their support for Palestinians by targeting southern parts of the occupied territories with missiles. They've also targeted several Israel-bound ships in Bab al-Mandab and the Red Sea. The Yemeni army announced on December 9th that all Israel-bound ships would be targeted until the Gaza onslaught and siege continues.
If Gaza does not receive the food and medicine it needs, all ships in the Red Sea bound for Israeli ports, regardless of their nationality, will become a target for our armed forces.
Following the announcement, Danish shipping company Maersk said it would pause all container shipments through the Red Sea. The company said its shipments would be sent on a detour around Africa until further notice. French shipping group CMA-CGM has also halted all shipments through the Red Sea. The Yemeni army's move is reported to have caused huge economic losses for the regime. Israel waged a devastating genocidal war on Gaza on October 7th, after the territory's Palestinian resistance movements carried out a surprise retaliatory attack, dubbed Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, against the occupying entity over its intensified violence against Palestinians. Now it seems the regime is facing an all-out crisis on different fronts.
UN agencies continue to sound the alarm bell over the desperate humanitarian situation in the besieged coastal territory. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has warned that the people of Gaza are running out of time and options. Philippe Lazzaroni warned that Gaza is very far from an adequate humanitarian response.
The people of Gaza are running out of time and options as they face bombardment, deprivation, and disease in an ever shrinking space.
He described the situation in Gaza as hell on earth and said people in the Palestinian territory are facing the darkest chapter of its history since 1948. He described seeing people halting in aid truck and in desperation and swallowing down the food found inside where they stood in the street. Further noted that the people of Gaza are now crammed into less than one-third of their original territory near the Egyptian border, and the dire situation might spark an exodus. The city of Rafah on the Egyptian border, the only crossing where aid is entering Gaza, has seen its population explode from 280,000 to more than a million.
Rafah is the epicenter of the displacement of the Gazan. There is over 1 million people who have fled in this governorate, most of them, as we know, have been moved more than once since the beginning of the war. Rafah has quadrupled its number of people overnight, and especially when the offensive in the south has started.
UN officials have warned that any such exodus would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and it would make a problematic Palestinian problem more difficult. It is now widely believed that the Israeli regime is deliberately targeting residential areas and the critical infrastructure in Gaza in order to make the territory unlivable for its residents. Israel has already pushed the U.S. and its other Western allies to persuade Egypt to accept Palestinian people in the Sinai Peninsula.
It seems very difficult to us that if there was a population movement outside Gaza, I think that can only mean Egypt. It would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and that would make a solution to the Palestinian problem even more difficult.
The healthcare system is collapsing. Expect public order to completely break down soon. And an even worse situation could unfold, including epidemic diseases and increased pressure for mass displacement into Egypt. I said that we are facing a severe risk of collapse of the humanitarian system.
UNRWA and many other aid organizations have already issued serious warnings about the dire conditions in Gaza. The UN Humanitarian Office also said that Gaza faces a public health disaster due to the collapse of its health system and the spread of disease. Doctors in Gaza are warning about the spread of diseases, especially among children, due to overcrowding and unhygienic conditions of makeshift camps, as well as the lack of medicine and clean water there. The lack of food, clean water, and shelter have worn down hundreds of thousands of traumatized people, and with the health system on its knees, its inevitable epidemics will rip through the territory.
We all know that the healthcare system is or has collapsed. We've got a textbook formula for epidemics and a public health disaster. This is in part, of course, because the shelters have long ago exceeded their full capacity, with people lining up for hours just to get to a toilet.
According to the data compiled by the World Health Organization, from November 29th to December 10, cases of diarrhea in children under the age of 5 jumped 66% and climbed 55% for the rest of the population in the same period. The UN agency said the numbers were inevitably incomplete due to the meltdown of all systems and services in Gaza because of the war. Doctors of the pediatric ward at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza have told reporters that the ward was overrun with children suffering extreme dehydration, causing kidney failure in some cases, while severe diarrhea was four times higher than normal.
The conditions of the war have led to the spreading of a lot of epidemics and sicknesses, the first epidemic of which has been one of acute gastroenteritis, which we have most frequent cases of in the children's ward. There are a number of patients come with cases of extreme dehydration, some of which can get to the point of kidney failure or weakening kidney function. Things are very bad.
I have four children with gastrointestinal diseases and flu. My youngest son has a cold, but we don't have any medicine. I have never felt as helpless and miserable in my life as I do now.
Since the truce between Israel and Hamas collapsed on December 1, hundreds of thousands of people have moved to makeshift shelters, abandoned buildings, schools, and tents. Many others are sleeping in the open with little access to toilets or water to bathe.
Children sleep in the tent, while some adults have no choice but to sleep on the streets. There's no food, no water. The children lack milk and diapers. The situation is dire, with no sanitary conditions or toilets.
Gaza's 2.3 million people now find themselves in a daily struggle to find enough clean water to survive. Residents are forced to take seawater for daily use, despite health risks. The United Nations General Assembly has overwhelmingly passed a resolution calling for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the Israeli regime's months-long genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. The 193-member Assembly adopted the resolution with 153 votes in favor. 10 countries voted the resolution down, including the U.S., in line with this unfaltering political support for the Israeli regime. The U.S., however, does not hold the veto power at the Assembly, unlike the U.N. Security Council, where it has blocked successive such resolutions. The resolution demands an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, as well as a swift and unconditional release of all captives. It also urges all parties to comply with international law. The vote is non-binding, but is seen as an expression of the views of the international community. It also increases pressure on Israel to end its onslaught on Palestinians. Ambassadors and other diplomats burst into applause at the vote count, which showed much higher support than an October 27 Arab-sponsored resolution that called for a humanitarian truce. Iran's permanent ambassador to the UN urged the international community to decisively address the barbaric crimes of Israel.
One member state, a permanent member of Security Council, misusing its unequal authority of veto power and in clear disregard to the united will of international community, has decided to stand with Israeli criminal regime and materially enable this regime in its ongoing massacre against civilians in Gaza. The United States blatantly opposing a ceasefire with means prescribing war violence and eventually more death for children and women in Gaza.
Meanwhile, Australia, a traditional ally of the U.S., has sided with the UN General Assembly resolution calling for a humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. It has been described a rare split with its close allies, the U.S. and the U.K.
Australia, alongside 152 other countries, was among the countries which voted in favour. In doing so, we joined Canada, New Zealand, Japan, France and India, and many other countries.
Now, the significance of this vote was that not only is it showing that the support that Israel had from many Western states especially for its military assault on Gaza is eroding, and even staunch supporters of Israel like Australia and like Canada are now saying we need a ceasefire.
World leaders must take a brave and bold stance against those who are fueling the flames of settler colonial violence.
And so what this shows is that Israel is isolated, the United States is isolated. The General Assembly, which is the world's parliament and which is the most democratic organ in the United Nations, has said, we overwhelmingly want an immediate ceasefire. Now, at the same time, and this is where sometimes you feel there's a parallel reality, you hear the United States voting against that, you see the United States voting against that resolution, and at the same time, words from the Biden administration about Israeli indiscriminate bombing.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Due to sparse traffic at Israel's Ben Gurion International Airport, the airport authority has decided to put 600 employees on unpaid leave, according to Israeli media. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The airport authority at Ben Gurion Airport decided on the move after negotiations with the Workers' Committee after almost all foreign airlines stopped flying to Ben Gurion Airport due to the war, the Hebrew version of the Ynet News website reported recently. 600 employees will be placed on unpaid leave and 1,000 more will be reduced to 75% of their current jobs, the newspaper reported, citing official sources. For its part, the Israeli Broadcasting Corporation, the KAN, reported that the number of workers at Ben Gurion Airport is 4,600 employees. Following the job cuts, the number will be reduced to 3,000. The global demand for travel to the occupied Palestinian territories has increased significantly since the launch of the Al-Aqsa flood operation and Israel's war on Gaza. The majority of international companies have suspended flights to and from the Israeli airport. We hope that the scope of activity in Israel will continue to expand and that we'll be able to get workers back to work as soon as possible, the Israeli Airport Authority said in a statement. The statement added, the Airport Authority hoped that the war would not affect the functioning of the airports, but hopes are separate from reality. Industry sources said that the decision to put the workers on unpaid leave was made only in recent days after seeing that the expectation was that the Ben-Gurion airport would not return to normal operations in January as well, according to the Ynet News website. Pinchas Idan, chairman of the Workers' Committee, told Ynet News, I pray that the war will end as soon as possible and that the work will return in full. We did the right thing because after COVID-19 pandemic, we drew conclusions. According to the Cradle, on 6th of November this year, the Financial Times published an extraordinary investigation tracking the devastating economic toll of Israel's war on Gaza, its impact reverberating across personal finances, job markets, businesses, industries, and the Israeli government itself. The Financial Times reports that the war had disrupted and ravaged thousands of companies, many teetering on the brink of collapse, with entire sectors plunged into an unprecedented crisis. Data cited from Israel's Central Bureau of Statistics reveal a bleak reality. One in three businesses in Israel have either shuttered or are operating at 20% capacity since Operation Al-Aqsa flood commenced on 7th of October and punched a hole in Israeli national confidence. More than half of businesses face revenue losses surpassing the 50% mark. The southern regions close to Gaza bear the brunt, with two-thirds of businesses either closed or functioning to a minimum. Adding to the crisis, Israel's Labour Ministry reports that 764,000 citizens, close to a fifth of Israel's workforce, are jobless due to evacuations, school closures, mandating childcare responsibilities, or reverse duty call-ups. Recently, the Bloomberg News Agency put numbers to the economic impact of Tel Aviv's military belligerence. The Gaza war has cost the Israeli economy almost $8 billion to date, with a further $260 million in losses occurred with every day that passes. Despite this, the dire situation, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is heavily reliant on support from right-wing, ultra-Zionist political factions, persists in allocating vast sums to non-essential ideological and settler colonial projects, diverging from the typical wartime economy protocol. Netanyahu has earmarked a record 14 billion shekels, or $3.6 billion, in discretionary spending for the five political parties comprising his coalition government, much of it intended for religious schools and the development of illegal Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. In a bitter irony of the war in Gaza, multiple Israeli construction projects have temporarily ground to a halt as they primarily relied on exploitation of Palestinian labourers. The Financial Times reports that Israelis are upset at the sight of Arab workers holding heavy tools, so they don't want to have Palestinian workers there. Such disenfranchisement comes despite many businesses being reduced to pleading for donations to remain afloat. Tourism, a potential economic lifeline, offers little respite for Tel Aviv. Figures from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, depict international travel contributing a mere 2.8% to Israel's gross domestic product and supporting 230,000 jobs, just over 6% of the total workforce. Despite persistent efforts throughout 2022 to revive tourism, October saw a massive 76% year-on-year decline in tourism. The onset of an Al-Aqsa flood operation further decimated travel, with daily flights to and from Ben Gurion Airport plummeting from 500 to a mere 100. The catastrophe unfolding is not lost on Tel Aviv's economists, 300 of which on 1st of November urged Prime Minister Netanyahu and his finance ministers to come to your senses due to the grave blow that Israel was dealt. They believe the cataclysm requires a fundamental change in national priorities and a massive rechanneling of funds to deal with war damage, aid to victims, and the rehabilitation of Israel's economy. Despite such rhetorical bombast, there are ample indications the Zionist regime is as dangerously deluded about its economic sustainability as its military prowess. Reports published by Tel Aviv's Startup Nation Policy Institute think tank reveal a grim outlook. Just 2 weeks after the Al-Aqsa flood operation erupted, the organization issued a study on damage to Israel's technology sector, once a source of national pride and joy, and a bellwether for its prosperity more generally. Even at that early stage, the Startup Nation Policy Institute forecast a rapidly impending economic crisis whose force is still unknown based on its survey. In all, 80% of Israeli technology firms reported damage resulting from the country's worsening security situation, while a quarter recorded double damage, both in human resources and in obtaining investment capital. Over 40% of technology companies had investment agreements delayed or cancelled, or just 10% were in managing to have meetings with their investors. The uncertainty and the resulting decision of many investors to sit on the fence due to the current situation hits an ecosystem that was already struggling to raise capital, partially due to the potential instability on the eve of the war, combined with a worldwide economic recession. Another reason for the Israeli technology sector's failure, unmentioned by the S&P but investigated by the Cradle on 13th of October, is the exposure of Tel Aviv's electronic surveillance and warfare system vulnerabilities by Al-Aqsa flood operation. That report concluded that Palestinian resistance operation would likely lead to a significant decline in the fortunes of Israel's cybersecurity sector, given it represents a grave and potentially terminal blow to the Startup Nation brand, which relies heavily on cybersecurity. The subsequent events have borne out this prediction.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with Iran's sports champions and medalists of the 2023 Asian Games and the Asian Paragames. This meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh on November 22, 2023. I would like to say a few words to the world's sport officials. It lies in them making the right decisions, in choosing coaches, in choosing the right composition in the national teams in all sports fields, and in preventing afflictions in sports. In other words, care must be taken so that afflictions do not hurt the country's sports. What do we mean by afflictions? They refer to economic corruption, the formation of sports mafias in the country, and the spread of immorality among our pure, virtuous athletes. You must watch out for these things. One of the responsibilities of the country's honorable sports officials is planning in order to fix the old problems in the country's sports. What are these old problems? There are unanswered questions such as, what role does the government have in sports? To what extent should the government become involved in sports or in sports teams?
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There is also the matter of privatization, the matter of sports contracts, the matter of foreign coaches, and other such matters. These are questions that have been raised, and an answer is given to them every once in a while. But then again, after some time, the answers change. Those should be planned for. A plan based on the principles of professional sports is needed. This is one of the country's true needs in sports. It is one of the important responsibilities of our sports officials. One of the responsibilities of the honorable sports officials is to attend to the living standards of the athletes, which has also been spoken about here. The things that the honorable minister said regarding housing, employment, and the like are all very good, provided these matters are followed up and seriously pursued. We cannot expect our athletes to make us proud in world competitions if we do not attend to their needs accordingly. Actions must be taken so that our athletes can rest assured that they will have a suitable standard of living.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.